University of Georgia Griffin campus invites you to join us for news and information about the many and varied programs and activities at the UGA Griffin campus. Information about gardening, the agriculture programs, and your UGA degree at the University of Georgia Griffin campus. Your UGA degree is closer than you think. This program is made possible by Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray and Company Realtors. Listen each Thursday at 9 o'clock a.m. for the UGA Griffin Campus News. This program is produced by WKEU AM 1450 and 102.3 FM and The Rock 88.9 FM and streamed live on our website, WKEUradio.com. Join us now with our guests from the UGA Griffin Campus.
Welcome to this week's installment of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News, being heard on all three WKU stations, as well as streaming live on the website at WKEUradio.com and available on our mobile app. Just type in WKEU in your app store, download the free app, and you can take us with you wherever you go. We are being joined today by Becky Griffin, who is on the University of Georgia Griffin campus, the Center for Urban Agriculture. She is the Community and School Garden Coordinator and Director of the annual Great Georgia Pollinator Census. But first, let us get to know a little bit about Becky Griffin outside of the academic realm. Becky, if you would, tell us a little bit about yourself, and if you wish, you can include your educational journey that has led you to this point.
All right. Well, good morning, and thank you, Tony. I am actually located at the Georgia Mountain Research and Education Center up in the beautiful North Georgia Mountains in Blairsville. So I have relocated up there in the past couple years. You may know, when you ask about my educational journey, I was late in getting my master's degree. I finished my master's degree just a couple of years ago at age 54. I was a very proud Griffin graduate. And I am mother of two kids. We love to hike and do kayaking and look at insects. How about that?
Now, what inspired you to continue your education a little bit later in life?
Well, I had an opportunity as a young person, and it didn't work out, and it always bothered me. It was just one of those things hanging over me, and I was blessed with a good support system, both professionally and personally, and my kids were older, and the timing was right, so all the stars aligned, and it was a lot of work, and I could do a sitcom about being the oldest one in the graduating class. I mamaed a lot of those young people, giving them advice on career paths and even dating advice. So I wouldn't trade it for anything. I'm so glad I did it.
Well, you know, not to stray too far from the subject, but, you know, you are a bit into mating, and at least as far as pollinators are concerned, as the topic of this week's program is the upcoming third annual Great Georgia Pollinator Census, which is coming up in the latter stages of the month of August. Could you tell people what the census is exactly?
Sure. And when you say that the third annual census is coming up, I just want to throw confetti and jump around. I'm so excited about it. This is a citizen science project where Georgians across the state count pollinators. They count insects that land on their pollinator plants, and they upload that data to our project website, and that we use that data, or researchers are using that data for all sorts of important scientific inquiries. But it is also a way to get to know a little bit about the insects in your own backyard, and I think that's my favorite part about the whole project.
Well, what would you say as director of the census coming up? What are the express goals of the program?
Well, our first goal is to create sustainable habitat for pollinators across our state. A lot of times we have people move in from other parts of the country where they might not have our humid summers, or they might not experience the drought that we inevitably get around July and October. So we want to make sure that those people, as well as our native Georgians, know what plants attract insects and the least amount of trouble. And so that part of the project starts in January. We start educating people about creating pollinator habitats, expanding the ones that they have, adding a diversity of plant shapes and flowers. So that's the first goal. The second goal is to increase the knowledge of our citizens about the insects they see. People oftentimes equate insects with negative thoughts. They're scared of insects, or they're gross, or I don't want to be around those, when in actuality, only 3% of insects are pests to humans. The rest can benefit us greatly. And as I explained to a teacher who is in the program, I would love everyone to go from, ooh, it's a bug, to look at the tarsal claw on that bee. You know, I want to get people excited about insects. So that was the second goal. And the third, of course, is to generate data. This is a citizen science project that isn't just a feel-good project where you get to go out and count insects. The data is really used. We're using it, our researchers are using it on pollination crop valuation studies. How much does pollination mean to Georgia economy and our agriculture? And we hope to use it to look at pollinator population trends as we get more and more data year after year.
Well, for somebody like me, let's start on the ground floor. And could you describe for us what exactly a pollinator is, what classifies as a pollinator?
Sure, and that's a really great question. So a pollinator technically is anything that moves pollen from one part of a plant to another. So technically, Tony, you and I are pollinators when we work out in the garden and we're moving pollen around. But for this case, we're interested in our insect pollinators. We have wonderful bats are great pollinators as well as hummingbirds. But for this study, we're looking for 8 categories of insect pollinators. We're looking for carpenter bees, bumblebees, small bees, honeybees, wasps, which are good pollinators, flies, butterflies, and then anything else you see on that plant that doesn't fit one of those categories goes into the other category.
Now, can some insects that are somewhat harmful to plants, aphids, for example, or to gardens, can they be considered pollinators? Do they provide some ancillary benefit commensurate with some of the harm that they can cause?
Well, I love how you're looking for the bright side of aphids because it's really hard to find. When asked that question, my answer is the bright side of aphids is that they provide food for other insects. So other insects eat them. They are a problem, and especially when you grow things like milkweed or even crops like lettuce, they're a problem. But luckily, when we are attracting things like wasps and insects into our garden, those predators can help check some of that aphid population for you.
Now, in getting people to participate in the Great Georgia Pollinator Census, is there some measure that you and the people working with you have to work with the public in terms of overcoming their fear of the harmful insects, the wasps, the hornets, that can be beneficial but can, you know, hurt if they sting?
Right, yes. And yes, we definitely do, especially when the project first started. But if you've ever sat outside and looked in your garden, you will see these insects coming and going and totally ignoring you, unless, of course, you're going to grab one. I wouldn't recommend grabbing a great black wasp. But just sitting in your garden or working in your garden, you're not really interacting with the insects very much. You're not on their radar. They're interested in what the pollen and the nectar and what's going on in that garden. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite comments I get back from someone who has just completed the census was, I had no idea. They sat outside for the 15 minutes to count insects with maybe some sweet tea, and they just watched, and they saw beautiful wasps and all sorts of bees that weren't interested in them and saw that diversity. So their fear became admiration. And when someone admires something, they want to help it, right? So we're hoping that this project generates a whole generation of pollinator conservationists.
Well, not just in the garden, but in the wild as well. How important are pollinators to the flowering of gardens and plants? Again, not just in the backyard, but, you know, in the woods and anywhere else where you might see forestation?
Well, the first and the concise answer is it is invaluable. Their services are invaluable. We have to have pollination for seed production of plants. Plants have to have pollination many times to continue that plant going on. So for nature, it is an invaluable service. And if you ever study it or get very interested in it, you will see that plants and insects have done this dance for eons of how do the flowers attract the pollinators to get that pollen move to make more seeds so that the next generation of that plant continues. Well, invaluable is what they are, and Many people, even gardeners who love to garden, don't know a lot about the insects that visit. They don't know their habitat, where they spend the winter, or how they're carrying pollen. So it is definitely an educational journey.
Well, you touched on this just a moment ago, but how do pollinators impact the Georgia and national economies?
Huge. So if we look at, Georgia has a state pollinator protection plan. It's called Protecting Georgia's Pollinators. And this was developed by, I guess, about 100 stakeholders in response to the EPA's suggestion that each state have one. And what they found, and this was back in 2014, so I know the numbers have increased somewhat, is that the impact annually of pollination to Georgia is over $360 million. So it's not just a ecological need. It benefits us economically as well.
Well, there wouldn't be a Protecting Georgia's Pollinators organization or group if there weren't some danger to the pollinating population. How in danger are the bees and the beneficial insects that help pollinate our gardens?
Well, it's definitely something that should be on everyone's radar. If you are a farmer, a food grower, or any kind of gardener, I know it's already on your radar. But when you think about insect habitat, so we know that we're providing flowers, we're providing food for them, but what about nesting? When we tear down what we would consider a wild area to put up a strip mall, we have totally erased habitat for possibly millions of insects that maybe nest underground or nest in broken twigs or broken flower stems. So habitat loss is critical. We're seeing it. I don't really know what we can do about it, except when we create a new subdivision or create a new strip mall, that we try and think of green space that goes along with it to maybe help mitigate some of the damage we've done by eradicating so much habitat.
Well, you mentioned that you're looking for information from 8 different varieties of insects. Will the people participating in the survey be expected to be able to differentiate those 8 types?
Yes, and that's the fun part, really, of this project. Well, there's many fun parts, but when we started this, the thought process behind this, we did 2 years of pilot projects where we had to come up with accounting criteria that people could do without being an entomologist. We're not asking people to go to species-level identification details. So we wanted something that you did have to learn a little entomology, but not a lot. The average citizen, a school child could learn. And we also needed that data to be meaningful. So we wanted to ask questions that were a little bit challenging, not overwhelmingly so, and be able to give data that the scientists can choose as valid, that is useful for us. So the categories that we mentioned are really easy to learn to tell apart. So I'll give you a good example. Are you ready, Tony?
I am ready.
Entomology.
And I hope it's the carpenter and bumblebee thing, because I still remember that from last year.
There you go. So why don't you tell everybody, what is the difference between a carpenter bee and a bumblebee?
Well, just the simple trick that I use to differentiate is that carpenter bees are a little hairier. Or do I have that backwards?
Yeah. So we have carpenter bees are those bees that sometimes we don't like because they'll be chewing in our wood structures, right?
I've lost
so
a lot of
abdomen.
Yeah, I've lost a lot of broom handles so far this spring.
Yeah, there you go. So their abdomen is nice and smooth. They can get in and out of those holes. So we say that they have a shiny hiney, whereas a bumblebee is fuzzy and furry all over. And we say that that bumblebees have fuzzy rears. So carpenter bee, shiny hiney, bumblebee, fuzzy rears. So already that's one thing that you've learned that you can take to the census and confidently tell those two insects apart.
Yes, you have corrected an error that I made for the last 366 days, considering that last year was a leap year. So, yeah, I do appreciate that. Now, this year, the census, you know, when you first started this, it was held in February. Well, it was held in the spring, but we talked about it in February. Is the August window that you're using this year, the 20th and 21st, is that an ideal window of time for people to see most of the pollinators that will flower and it's spread, they were piling?
Well, it is ideal for the project because we had to have a date where something is blooming all over the state. And, you know, up in, here in the mountains, we get a little behind. We also needed something, a date where schools could participate. And, you know, in the spring, schools are busy with field day, spring break, testing. It's the last thing teachers want to do is mess with a new project. So we also are concerned about weather. We used to do some pilot projects in October. Well, October is tornado hurricane season. We actually had a count wiped out because we had a hurricane come through. So August, that last little bit of August, meets all the criteria. Now, that being said, my friends in Tifton, they are not happy with me because it's awfully hot at the end of August to get outside and count insects. But it is the ideal time for this project.
Well, now, who participates in the census? I mean, do you go to garden clubs, schools? What is your target audience for participation?
Target audience is a Georgia citizen. That's it. We have people from all age groups, all demographics, whether you're living in the city, the country, the suburb, an apartment in Atlanta. We have the monks of the Monastery of the Holy Spirit participate in Conyers. We have over 100 schools participate in the census. We have even some businesses allow their employees to visit a pollinator garden and count as part of their community outreach. So basically, it's anybody in the state of Georgia who wants to be part of something bigger than themselves that makes a real difference for our conservation.
Well, nothing like this, the scope of involving the entire state can happen in a vacuum. So who helps lead this project in addition to yourself?
Well, we have extension agents across the state. So every state in Georgia, you know, has an extension agent, and they all either help by educating about the census or they may have events on their at their demonstration garden. We also partner with most of the major universities, Georgia Tech, University of North Georgia, Kennesaw State. They're all project partners. The Rosalind Carter Butterfly Trail is a project partner. They have events down there. So Callaway Gardens, Smith-Gilbert Gardens, just a lot of major players who feel the same way I do about insects are either having events or help promote the census. So it definitely is a statewide team group effort to do this project.
Well, with you being in Blairsville and this being a local program, will there be someone assigned to the Research and Education Garden on the University of Georgia Griffin campus assigned to count pollinators for at least a portion of the census?
Well, I believe in the past, and I'm not sure with the regulations now, in the past they've had events where the public can come and visit the garden on one of those days and count with maybe some help, somebody there. We're not sure if that's going to be possible depending on how things go, but we do know that garden has an amazing pollinator plants everywhere, and anyone is invited to go when it's open and count pollinators and ask for help from somebody that's already there. So it's definitely going to be a hot spot for counting.
Well, you talked about how schools and students can get involved with their teachers in this project. Is this something business and industry can also participate in?
Yes, and that was kind of a surprise to me. What ended up happening is we've had businesses contact me and say, I want to do this. An example is a brewery. A brewery wants to have an event at their brew pub to celebrate pollinators. Maybe sell some mead, I don't know. But we have decided to help them out a little bit more this year. We have added on our website a business tab with resources for businesses who want to have events, either for clients coming in or for their employees. We have an example of an easy landscape plan that anyone can follow that will have pollinator plants that bloom in August. So we are responding to their requests for help and information to get pollinators counted at businesses this year. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, Becky Griffin, who is on the University of Georgia Center for Urban Agriculture, and she's also the Community and School Garden Coordinator and Director of the great annual Georgia Pollinator Census. Last year with COVID, were you surprised by the participation, or were you left a little disappointed that people couldn't get out like they might otherwise because of the pandemic?
Well, that's a good question, Tony. In 2019 was our first statewide year, and we went gangbusters. We had events, 140 events leading up to the census and on the census day across the state. People got excited. They counted. We had very little problems. And then with 2020, what do? We can't have events in August. I think there was one event across the state. So we actually kind of punted and spent time talking to people about counting at home with their families. We did have a big boom in gardening during COVID, so why not promote gardening for pollinators so that when August came around, all of our social media, our newsletters, our educational efforts went to let's count at home with our families. So we did things like post recipes from family and consumer science agents that involved pollinator foods like watermelon. We had a great watermelon salsa recipe we posted. We even came up with a Spotify playlist so you could actually listen to songs and get pumped up to go out and count. We had reports from across the state of families who multi-generation went out and counted pollinators together. So it turns out that we made lemons from lemonade. And we had 1,000 less counts than in 2019, but considering the circumstances, I was very pleased.
Well, now, how do the varieties of pollinators change with the widely differing geographic and natural features that you find here in Georgia?
Well, they differ somewhat, but not as much as you might think. If you're counting near water, if your pollinator garden is near water, you may see more dragonflies than, say, somebody who is counting where there's not a lot of water. A lot of our bumblebees are statewide. A lot of our native bees are also statewide. So we don't see as much geographical difference as you might think.
And so temperature as well, where it's a little bit warmer in the southern parts of the state, as you mentioned, Tifton, and a little bit cooler mm-hmm. in the area where you are in the North Georgia Mountains in the Blairsville region, there's not a great disparity?
Not too bad. Sometimes in Tifton, it's really hot and the flowers aren't producing a lot of nectar and their reproductive parts kind of dry up. So we're not seeing as many visits as you would maybe in June. But we're definitely seeing enough that we can document what's out there, which insect varieties are out there.
Do other states conduct pollinator census?
Some other states do. Some things, we're the only ones that are doing such a huge variety of insects that we're looking at in a concentrated time. And I'm working with my colleagues over in South Carolina, and they're hoping to do this census in South Carolina starting in 2022. And I've also had some interest in other states who kind of want to do the same thing that we're doing. It would be great if we could have the whole Southeast do this. And then we could really put together some great numbers on what's going on in the southeastern United States.
Well, let's say that you're able to light a fire under these other southeastern states and everybody starts to participate. What type of information can you derive, not just from Georgia, but from other areas, other states in the southeast with their pollinator counts?
Well, we could definitely see some differences in temperature and weather. We can definitely see, are we seeing the same things? Just like you ask about the state of Georgia, are we seeing the same numbers of small native bees up in South Carolina as we are here? And they can use that information, their state information, for pollination economic valuation studies in their state as well.
Now, what were some of the biggest surprises that you have received from some of the census results? I mean, has it gone as expected, or have there been certain nuggets of information that came along that maybe you weren't quite expecting?
Well, one of the nuggets was there's a category called small bees, and that's any bee that you see that's smaller than a honeybee. And what that means to me as an entomology lover is those bees are a big chunk of our native bees. And so we're seeing higher numbers of those native bees than I expected, which is very heartening. I was very excited about that. And another little side was when the census is going on and as we're educating people, we'll get pictures, what is this insect? And we are finding we are able to use the pollinator census people that are troops of counters to document the zebra long-wing butterfly having a northern into Georgia new range, which was something we hadn't seen really before, hadn't documented before. So that was also really nice, a nice surprise. And again, my favorite parts are people just calling up and are sending me notes saying, I'm on board now. What can I do to help pollinators? I just love them. My son now wants to go to entomology school. So those are the things that mean the most to me.
When we talked about what an economic impact pollinators are to the national and to the Georgia economy, but how might they use the results that you derive from your annual census?
Well, they can see how many native bees, small bees are out there that maybe farmers or especially smaller urban farmers could actually use that information to create more habitat, thinking that they may be more useful for pollination than previously thought. Maybe they didn't think there were that many of those native bees around. So that's really heartening. And using the information to look closer at bumblebees, are we increasing or decreasing our number of bumblebees? Those types of information. And again, you know, we've talked about it earlier, the tie into the economic issues with agriculture being the biggest driver in our state.
Well, let us just say that let me ask it this way. When someone chooses to participate in the annual Great Georgia Pollinator Census, which is upcoming August 20th and 21st, how big of a parcel are they expected to keep an eye on?
All right, that's a great question. So this is what the average Georgia citizen will do on either Friday the 20th or Saturday the 21st. You will go to the website, which is GGAPC.org, and you will look at the counting sheet. Maybe you want to print it off. You can use your phone as well. But you'll go to your garden, and you will find a pollinator plant that you see activity on. So there's no, I'm not having anyone look for any particular plant, just something in their garden maybe they think is pretty that's showing insect activity. And they need to, just for 15 minutes, count the insects that land on that plant. Now, sometimes that's tricky. Some people try and count on a huge abelia plant, and that's just not really possible. So maybe you want to find a smaller section of that plant. Or if you have a big bed of zinnias, you can't really tell where one plant ends and another begins. As long as you can tell me the name of that plant, and you're doing the best you can to count on one plant, that is all we're asking for.
So the plant doesn't necessarily have to be isolated, but you would prefer that it be narrowed down to a single plant or two as opposed to trying to watch, say, an entire rose bush.
Exactly, because sometimes that's just not going to be possible. And I want people to not be stressed about it. So find a plant that's going to be comfortable for counting and do your practicing. I know a lot of schools had practice counts before they let out in the spring because they'll be ready to come back in the fall. All the information that you need to participate. Even if you lived by yourself and never went anywhere but had an internet connection, you can get everything you need from the website to be an active participant.
Now, should participants be worried about, like, for example, if we see a butterfly land on our plant, it is pretty easy to tell one butterfly from another based on their coloration, size, and things of that nature, but a bumblebee may fly away and come back and we've actually counted the same pollinator twice. Should that be a
right.
concern, or is that something that you know goes with the territory?
I know that goes with the territory. And the statisticians that helped me develop the counting criteria, we know that's happening. Because with the butterfly, like you said, we can tell that monarch has left and not come back, and we might not be able to tell, is that the same bumblebee or not? You know, so by counting every time an insect lands on the plant and doing that for all of those insects, we have evened out the statistics a little bit.
Now, when it comes to insecticides, unfortunately, they harm pollinators as much as they harm aphids and other harmful insects. Do you want people to try to make an effort to pick plants that have not been recently doused in insecticide just to help a more natural count?
Well, definitely. But the bigger picture for me is hopefully if they've signed on to this project and have been involved in our social media efforts and our newsletter and working with their local extension agents, they're not spraying anything on pollinator plants anyway. If they have to, they're picking off insects and putting them in soapy water or using packing tape to pick off some insect eggs that are undesirable. But so the short answer to the question is yes, we want them to pick plants that haven't been doused. And the long answer is, why are you dousing and what can we do to prevent that next time?
Now, is this strictly for ornamental plants, or will something in the vegetable garden be necessary to be included to help give you an accurate pollination count?
Well, there's not really any crops that are going to have flowers that are going to attract a lot of pollinators. However, we do have a lot of people who use herb plants. So things like basil and thyme, in that part of the season, they've let them flower, and they're very attractive to pollinators. So we do get herb counts on herbs as well.
So that does become beneficial. Now, what is the significance of the 15-minute timing window?
The significance is it's long enough for you to kind of settle in and get an idea of what's visiting your plant without becoming bored or too hot. How about that?
Well, now, I'm one that likes to sit outside in the spring and summer. If I want to participate, say, once in the morning and once in the evening on the Friday the 20th and Saturday, August 21st, am I allowed to do that? And if I do, should I average out my time and what I've seen over those combined 15-minute sessions, or should I report each one individually?
You are welcome to count as many times as you want. You can count at home and on one day and count at your friend's neighbor's house the next day, but those counts need to be individually uploaded separately. Now, that being said, if you are a teacher and you are doing this and you have, like, all of the fifth grade is counted and you have verified their counts and you're looking at 30 pieces of paper to be uploaded, we do have a way for those who are holding events, those who are teachers and have large numbers, to upload them an easier way. But for the individual who's just counting a couple times, please upload those counts separately.
Now, I don't mean to put you on the spot, Becky, but I have to ask, because last year, we were unable to participate in events because of the COVID crisis, and as of today, the state has lifted the state of emergency concerning the health crisis and COVID-19. What kind of events might someone come up with to help promote the count and get more people involved? What are some of the more unique ideas you've seen?
Well, I have seen neighborhoods decide that they're embracing this event, and they call themselves a pollinator-friendly neighborhood. And so the neighbors get together, and they'll cook out, and they will count. So that's pretty fun. As I mentioned, I know a brewery have counted. We have had family reunions centered around the pollinator count, where we have multi-generations actually counting at maybe grandmother's house.
And these are...
We also... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Also, as we get closer, talk to your local extension agent. I know several of them are in the planning stages of having events maybe at the extension office or at their demonstration gardens. If you live close to a beautiful garden, like the garden at the Research Center in Griffin or the Botanical Gardens, contact them and see what they've got going on. If you're not comfortable counting alone, you want a little more help with your ID, or you just want to be part of the group. So just be on the lookout. We update our website as we get events in, and just contact some local areas. And if you don't see something, an event, start one of your own. I'll be very happy to help you do that.
Now, I personally am a big proponent that more information is always preferable to less. But ideally, is there a threshold where you have to have a minimum number of responses and participation in the pollinator census for the count to be effective and useful to you as a scientist?
For the researchers, probably so. But for me, as a proponent of education in the sciences, I say no. If we can educate anybody and get kids excited and families excited about pollinator conservation and best management practices, and then that to me is a win. But that being said, don't jinx me now, Tony. I'm looking for at least 5,000 participants this year.
Now,
that's my goal.
Ideally, does it help the researchers if all 100, at least one person in all 159 Georgia counties participates?
Yes, of course. The more the merrier. And I think Between the last 2 years, we've had participation in 134 of the 159 counties. And so those counties where we did not have participation last time, I have been working with people in those counties to see what we can do to up participation.
Now, in past censuses, or censi, I guess maybe the proper plural on that, how far ranging has the participation been within the state?
Oh, all over. We've had from the mountains down to Savannah, down to Tifton, Valdosta, middle of the state, Macon, big in Macon. The metro counties show up every time. The ones that have not participated, the counties are just a pocket here or there, and they're mostly what you would think, the rural counties in middle and south Georgia, the big farming country, counties.
Is there a preferred time of day in which someone might see more active pollinators, early in the morning, later in the evening, and maybe trying to avoid the heat of the day, or is that up to someone's personal preference?
It's up to your personal preference. I usually like to try and go when it's just warmed up enough that we know the insects are flying, but it's not too hot to where, it's not comfortable to be out there. Definitely try for sunny areas. The insects fly where it's sunny, so you want to make sure, pick a full sun plant to do your counts, and keep your fingers crossed that we don't have rain. Last year, on Saturday of the count, we had rain all across the state almost all day, which is unprecedented for Georgia in August. Usually maybe we get an afternoon thunderstorm, right? But not rain all day. So we are hoping for a sunny weekend. We're hoping for lots of participation and lots of insects flying.
And in hurricane season to this year, cooperate.
Oh, please.
Now, how does someone find out more about the census? What internet services, since we are a web-savvy society now, particularly after the pandemic, what ways can we go online to find out more about your census?
All right. So we have a website, and it is gapc.org. And on the website, you can find an insect counting guide that teaches you the differences between the categories that you can download. We have a counting sheet you could print to take out to the garden, make it your memory a little clearer when you're making the counts. We have all sorts of resources for educators and business, just everything on the website. We also have a Facebook group called the Georgia Pollinator Census Facebook group. We have about 3,000 participants, and almost every day I post something about what's going on in the state. We start doing little quizzes on insect ID in August to get people ready. And also, your local extension agent will have all the information you would need on doing the census and events that are local to you.
Well, earlier you mentioned that, you know, there are other species aside from what we classify as pollinators that are beneficial in spreading pollen and in expanding our natural beauty, such as bats and things like that. Is there any thought to, in the future, maybe expanding the program or having a separate program that includes how they may benefit the pollination process?
There may be others that are looking at the census the way we have it set up and thinking about that, somebody who maybe has that as a specialty for their research. But for us, we're just going to stick with the insects and just enjoy them and keep learning more about them. But yes, this does not dismiss the work that the bats and the hummingbirds do, for sure.
Well, what attracted you originally to the field of entomology?
Well, when I was a kid, I grew up in Powder Springs, Georgia. And at that time, it was a very rural place. We had a 10-acre land, and I raised chickens and just a really little farm girl, and I became fascinated with honeybees. And we had a library, the Powder Springs Library, and we had one book on bees and how they are a super organism and how their hives arrange. And I believe I checked that book out maybe 12 times. You know, I'm old school. We didn't have the internet. You know, any new thing we got, we had to get from the library. And I would love to have that book now to see that little page where your name is cursed in that you checked it out. And then over time, I just got more and more interested. When I managed a 4-acre farm garden, I noticed I could smell the seven from homeowners nearby and knew I'd have pollination issues. So all those things, you know, my life's journey kind of led me to this project. And it is definitely my passion project.
Well, as I am pulling it up on our computer here, on the website that you mentioned for the pollinator count, ggapc.org, are there a list of definitions of the 8 varieties of pollinators that people should be on the lookout for?
Yes. If you click on the insect counting and identification guide, that is a little booklet that gives you the details of each of those categories, complete with lots of pictures. So it's very simple to master the counting criteria.
Yeah, I see that you have an insect and counting guide. It's complete with photos, and it can be downloaded from the website. Now, what type of distance do you recommend someone to make their count from? I mean, there are people, as you say, and I'm one of them, that actively avoids wasps and hornets and things of the stinging variety. What would you consider a safe distance to avoid being bothered? Of course, most wasps and things like that aren't going to bother you unless you bother them. But right. At what distance do you recommend the participant be from the plant they wish to count?
I just want the participants to be comfortable. So if you are comfortable just a few feet away, knowing that those wasps are not interested in you, then that is terrific. If you're a little nervous, maybe back up a little bit more, just whatever distance that you're comfortable. And I do have people that will do their 15-minute counts, log their results in to the website, and then they'll go back with their phone or camera because they've seen some pretty interesting things they never saw before, and they want to document those with pictures. So if you want to have your cell phone handy to either count with or when your counts are finished, get some pictures, I highly recommend that as well.
Well, now you also have a great Georgia Pollinator podcast. Is that something you will do for the 2021 census and tell people about how they can find those Spotify and Apple podcasts?
Right. Yes, we have a podcast. I'll be honest with you. I'm a little behind on uploading some of our content, but twice a month or so, we interview somebody that is working in the pollinator field, something I think would be of interest to the people who participate in the census. And you can find that. It's called the Great Georgia Pollinator Podcast, and it's on Spotify and Anchor. And if you, anybody out there knows somebody that you think would be good for the podcast, they can let me know. We're always looking for Georgians who are active in pollinator conservation. So, yes, so podcast is something that will be ongoing.
Okay, so let us say that our classroom or us as individuals have participated in the pollinator census. How quickly do we need to get that information beyond the August 21st, second day of the census to you?
I usually keep the portal to upload results for 2 weeks.
So you get that 2 week window.
And especially if you're in charge of events and you just have a ton to do and those papers are sitting on your desk, we give you 2 weeks to make sure that you upload your counts.
Now, one of the things that gets covered on the podcast, and you can find information online as well through UGA Extension, is the building of pollinator habitats. With today being July the 1st, is there time between now and August 20th and 21st when the census actually takes place to build something suitable that will attract pollinators?
Yes, definitely so. The trick is anything that you are putting in the ground now, you're going to have to water because we're getting ready to get hot and dry in Georgia. So you'll definitely need to keep that into consideration. I actually have people who live in apartments in Atlanta or maybe don't have a big pollinator garden. And what they do is we'll go get a container like a whiskey half barrel at one of their local stores and then make a container garden. And that's a little bit easier to maintain during the summer, picking plants that will be blooming in August like asters and, you know, zinnias and depending on where you live in Georgia. And they baby that for a month or so, and then they have beautiful blooms to count on in August.
How vital is cross-pollination to nature?
Very vital. I've just been doing some research on that very topic, and what we're finding is even things, and of course it's plant-dependent, you know, we have those finicky apple plants that need a couple different pollinators sometimes to cross-pollinate with, but even plants like tomatoes, which are we always think of as self-fertile or self-pollinating. By having pollen brought in from another tomato plant, what researchers are finding is a better quality tomato. So just like we think about, you know, when you go to the pound and you get that mutt dog that doesn't have any papers, but oh my gosh, what a great companion. What we're finding is the more cross-pollination with our food crops, oftentimes the higher quality crop results.
Okay, well, if you would remind people, Becky, the website for people to participate, and you can download this at any time prior to August 21st and the 20th and 21st, correct?
Correct, and I am. We're getting closer, so I'm updating it almost daily with new activities, and the social media changes daily. But our website is ggapc.org.
And then again, you can also contact your local county extension agency, of course, Spalding County and all our listening counties from here to Muskogee County and beyond. I have extension agents available to help you with the pollinator census. Do you yourself, when you participate, do you participate as an individual or in a group setting?
And it depends on the year. I will be participating in events all day the 20th and all day the 21st. And I will be counting on my own home garden on the 21st. I will be counting at GymRec part of the day on the 20th. So I'm all over during those days, helping people at events, doing some little education beforehand. And then I'm available for questions. If people have questions, they put them on the Facebook page, and we have a team that can answer any questions that people have. So I'm on call the 20th, well, pretty much now through the census, but definitely the 20th and the 21st for any kind of questions, and definitely counting.
Well, let us say that I count my own home and then go to the Research and Education Garden here on the Griffin campus and count in both places. You know, and the information, you know, may be just a little bit different. How does that help you in the count? I mean, what do you find? I mean, you mentioned earlier that, you know, there are areas of the state that may be more surrounded by water. There may be more dry areas, hilly, a little more shaded areas, you know, and what ways do the geographic conditions alter what a count might look like?
Well, I think the easiest way to answer that is to talk about if you're a person that has bought a house in a new subdivision and you got all the pollinator or all the plants that come with a standard home, well, maybe some boxwood holly, some things like that. You have a yard that is covered in beautiful grass, but over time you decide that you want to change that, and you create some habitat. So you maybe instead of grass, you put in a wildflower garden, or instead of those boxwood hollies, you maybe will put some goldenrod or something like that. What ends up happening is your counts that you took before you change will be less than the counts after. So I think that the little microclimate of what pollinator plants, how the pollinator plants are cared for, are there insecticides being sprayed, are there plants that are easier to care for, more native plants. So those things really make the big difference. And when you go to upload your counts, you will be asked questions like, what is the temperature today? If you look at the back of the insect counting guide, it has what we're going to ask you. So what your temperature is it raining? How big is your garden? You know, those type of things. And all of that data we save to give to the researchers who need it.
Well, dispel or confirm a myth for me that pollinators are more attracted to brightly colored plants.
Well, I think that's a broad statement. It depends on the pollinator. We know that bees can't see the color red very well, so they're going to respond more to flowers that are in the violet zone. So, it just depends on the pollinators. Some of our plants that don't look really pretty, don't have a beautiful bloom like mountain mint. If you saw a mountain mint plant, it just doesn't, it's not aesthetically gorgeous. It's not something you might want in your front walk, but it is one of the most attractive plants to all types of pollinators because it produces a lot of nectar.
Well, you raise
and,
it. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
And another point is a lot of times homeowners love when breeders breed these beautiful flowers, like maybe the impatiens with the double petals. We've all seen them. They're just spectacular. And they're very pretty, but they don't attract a lot of pollinators.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. Do pollinators, are they attracted by scent, by smell? I mean, by smell, by, you know, aroma? Is there certain scents that they're attracted to? I mean, I just learned that bees are basically colorblind to red.
Well, that is an interesting question. And what we are, let's see the best way to, we don't know a total answer to that, but we do know that insects will use chemical and physical cues to find their pollinator plants. And a good example is a squash bee. Squash bees come out to pollinate squash when it's still not quite light outside, but they find them.
So, I mean, that's just interesting in the variety of ways. I mean, I've always just assumed it was, you know, on a visual basis that pollinators would be attracted to the flower or the plant that they were going to buzz about. And it's interesting to find out there are a myriad of other factors that lead them to the plant they choose.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
we do have some bees that we call specialist bees, and they're looking for things like squash or blueberries. But lots of generalist bees that will pollinate everything.
Well, before we let you get away for the week, and we wish you a great deal of luck in the Great Georgia Pollinator Census, what are some of your favorite memories from your time on the University of Georgia Griffin campus, and what about it might you miss that you don't get to experience in Blairsville?
Well, the first thing is right now I know those magnolia trees are blooming. You know that Griffin campus, you walk in that campus anytime in the summer, you smell those beautiful magnolias. So that's one thing. I love the camaraderie of that smaller campus. When you are a student there, the professors know who you are, and you know who they are, which is really great when you're serious about your studies. So I miss the personnel. Most of all, I miss the people on campus.
Now, when you went to school, and I should have asked this earlier, when you furthered your education at a later stage in life than many do, were your children also in school at the time? And if so, did they give you a hard time about making sure your classwork assignments were done?
Yes. Well, they were older. I believe my older daughter is through with school, and my younger daughter was still in college. But they didn't really give me a hard time. But one favorite memory is when it was my first time for finals, first finals in 30 years. They both sent me a finals care package because that's what I would do for them. You know, with positive notes and treats, some cookies, things like that. It was amazing, and I still remember it as a very positive thing.
Well, they pollinated Mom's academia. How about that? Now, what would you say if you wanted to direct a student towards pursuing a career in urban agriculture at the University of Georgia?
Well, I would say that without being biased, the University of Georgia is one of the top ag schools in the world. And the personnel are amazing. I was always amazed in taking my classes when I would find out that the people teaching the classes are the ones responsible for this international research. So I would highly recommend, if you're interested in urban ag, any kind of ag, looking at UGA, look at the researchers, look what work goes on, you'll be impressed, and you'll really want to be a part of it.
Well, Becky, are there any final thoughts or any final words that you want to get out about the third annual Great Georgia Pollinator Census before we bring this morning's program to a close?
Well, I want to thank everyone who's counted in the past, and I want to welcome new counters as well as repeats. And, Tony, I can't wait to see your count.
Well, I do have to ask, have you found that you've had a lot of repeat customers, so to speak?
Oh, yes. I have people who participate one time, and then they're an advocate. They're not only raring to participate, they're trying to recruit others to participate as well. And that makes me happy. I like to see that. And again, it is a group. I mean, this would not happen without everyday Georgia citizens being part of it. So I'm so appreciative.
Well, I am definitely going to participate, so you will be getting at least two from me because I have a theory that I want to test out, and that I'm going to count one in my front yard and then one in my backyard a little closer to where the pool is. I just want to see if the pollinator count gets affected by the presence of chlorine in the general vicinity.
Oh, wow, that's a great idea. So you're doing a little scientific research of your own.
Well, anything I can do to help. It's the smallest contribution I will ever make to science.
Well, and it is very, very much appreciated.
Well, Becky Griffin, we very much appreciate your time, and we wish you luck on the third annual Great Georgia Pollinator Census. Becky works at the UGA Center for Urban Agriculture and is the Community and School Garden Coordinator, as well as the Director of the Great Georgia Pollinator Census, which is upcoming Friday, August 20th, and Saturday, August 21st. Becky, we very much appreciate your time. Always a pleasure, and enjoy the coolness of Blairsville.
I will do it, and please tell everyone on the Griffin campus I said hello, and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, ma'am.